What would you do if the ultimate tragedy, the murder of a child, happened to your family? And if the murderer was let off with what amounted to a judicial slap on the wrist? Would you be able to take the agony and turn it into something of a service to society by exposing to the world the failures of our criminal system? Well, Dominic Dunn has chosen that approach, and his writings, especially in the pages of Vanity Fair, have brought the light of truth and righteous indignation to many of the dark corners of our society. And now those essays have been collected in a new book called Justice, Crimes, Trials, and Punishments. It's published by Crown, and I'm delighted that it brings Mr. Dunn back to New York & Company today. Hi.
Hi, Leonard. It's so nice to be here.
What had you done before you became a journalist?
Oh, I had a long career in Hollywood. First I started out on... When I got out of college, my first job in the 1950s was as the stage manager of the Howdy Doody show. And then I went on to the big dramatic shows in live television, specifically as the stage manager for the Robert Montgomery show. Then I went out to Hollywood and did all the big live specials with Humphrey Bogart and Frank Sinatra and those people. And then I went on Playhouse 90. And then went into the movies.
But you'd never worked as a writer.
Never worked as a writer. I didn't start working as a writer until I had totally and completely destroyed my movie career and by drink and other substance. And at the age of 50, I left Hollywood. I moved to a cabin in the Cascade Mountains in Oregon, most lovely place, where I stayed without a telephone and without a television for 6 months. And
I can't imagine you, of all people.
I know. As socially gregarious as I am, I mean, I'm one of those people who goes out every night, and I have all my life. But I stayed by myself for 6 months. And, Leonard, it was one of the most incredible experiences of my life.
And when did you start writing? Did you?
I started writing there in that cabin.
And did you? Were you surprised by how easily it came? And
no, well, it didn't come.
Because you do have a style, and
yeah,
you have a.
But I have developed that. It didn't come. I mean, I've always been a good storyteller, and I could keep a dinner table entranced. But then when I first went to write it out, I mean, that which I think, you know, came out in like one paragraph, and then I think, what's wrong with this? This isn't, you know, this will grab nobody. So it took me a long time to develop, not a long time, but I came to it, to developing a style.
To find your own voice.
Yeah.
And you started writing the way you tell the story, because you haven't just written these things. You told me that when you were covering the O.J. trial, you had dinner appointments, I guess it was every Friday night at Nancy Reagan's and every Saturday night at Liz Taylor's, because they wanted you to tell them exactly what you'd seen over the week.
Yeah, yeah, that's absolutely right. Well, actually, you have it right, except for the day. I had Saturday lunch every Saturday during that trial with Nancy Reagan, who was shut in because of her husband, and she was obsessed, as I was obsessed, and I would tell her the stories, and then I'd go to Elizabeth's on Sunday evening. So,
so, did you? Does the telling of a story in some way help you to write this?
Yes, yes, it does.
You started off actually as a journalist by telling a reporter what you knew about Hollywood. He was looking into one of the great scandals of an earlier time, the Bagelman.
Beagleman. David Beagleman. And this is one of the great, great stories. I'll tell it very quickly. David Beagleman was the head of Columbia Pictures, one of the highest paid executives in America. And for whatever mad reason, he forged a check for $10,000 in the name of Cliff Robertson, the Academy Award winning actor. And he went to the teller in the bank and handed her the check, and with his overpowering presence got the money. Which he didn't need. I mean, it was like an aberration. And Cliff Robertson, when he got a W-2 form for something from Columbia Pictures, which he had not worked that year, he investigated, and everybody warned him, back off, and he kept after it. That's what I so admire about Cliff. And this became a great, played down, almost not mentioned by the Los Angeles papers through power, And then two reporters from the Washington Post came out at the behest of Dina Merrill, who talked to Kay Graham, Dina then being Cliff's wife. And one of the reporters recognized me. And he had been a roommate or a classmate of my brother, Stevens, at Georgetown University, recognized the family resemblance. I knew every detail of that case. And I traveled with these guys for a week, and I watched two investigative reporters break a case.
And you say that was a great on-the-job training.
It was just fabulous.
The book you have given us now is called Justice, which was also the title of your first magazine article. This is before you even started writing fiction, because you've been here as the author of a novel. You've done a number of different things after you finally started writing, but Justice was the first ever, and that had to have been the most difficult article that you've ever written, because that was personal.
It was personal. That was covering the trial of the man who had murdered my daughter. And it was Tina Brown, quite honestly, who was soon to become the editor of Vanity Fair, but was not yet. I met her the night before I was to leave for the trial, and she heard me talking about Hollywood, actually. And she called me up the next day, and she said to me, "If you keep a journal, come and see me. I'm about to be made the editor of Vanity Fair. Come and see me when it's over." And I did keep a journal.
How long after you had spent that time in the cabin in Oregon was your daughter killed?
About a year and a half.
So you'd come back into society.
I had come back.
And then this shocking thing happened.
This thing that really threw me, really... it was the most devastating thing that could ever have happened. I absolutely adored my daughter, and I had talked to her on the night before she was killed. It was my birthday, and she was an actress, and she's telling me what happened on the set that day, and I loved all that, to hear all that actress stuff. And the next day, this guy who had stalked her, beaten her, which we didn't know, of course, at that time, he killed her.
In fact, he had strangled her before at one point, to the point where she needed no makeup to play a battered child on a television episode.
That's right. But we weren't, her mother and I weren't aware of that.
She was keeping all that secret.
She kept that, and then she left him, and then that's when he stalked her. And this man, it turned out, had a history of violence against women. Women came forward. There's one specifically who had been hospitalized twice by this guy who beat her so viciously and broke her nose and whatever, and horrible things. But the judge, this rotten judge, on the case ruled that inadmissible, and the defense was allowed to present a totally false picture of this guy to the jury.
So you found your daughter on trial instead of John Sweeney on
trial.
That's
right. That's right.
But can those kinds of things be appealed if a judge doesn't handle a case well, or is it only when a man is convicted under those kinds of circumstances?
Yeah, I'm actually not sure how to answer that. But my way of dealing with that judge was to write about it.
And did that hurt him?
You bet it did. It should have. And he did the most cowardly thing. He led the jury to the decision that they made, and then was, oh, how awful that they have come! How unjust that they have come! He was such a phony.
Now, why do you think that was? You say because he was susceptible to flattery?
Well, let me just give you a little story about him. He had a bad, difficult time with the prosecutor in the case, who was, of course, working for us, in a previous case. So they had a history, which was unpleasant between them.
Which should not affect the conduct of a trial.
Of course it shouldn't. Of course it shouldn't. But this is the way to best describe him. It was a very highly publicized trial in its time. It's 1982, and highly publicized in L.A. And one day in the courtroom, there was a photographer from People magazine, were using a long lens, and so he was taking pictures. And the judge stopped the trial, asked the photographer from People to meet him in chambers. The photographer thought he was going to be sent out of no pictures allowed or so forth. Instead, the judge showed him three pair of eyeglasses to see in which his eyes would show up best in the photographs. And that tells you exactly who that judge is.
But he did consider excluding your wife from the courtroom.
He did. My wife is an invalid. She's now dead. She was an invalid from multiple sclerosis. She had been she'd been ill for 25 years. And they tried to keep her out of the courtroom because being in a wheelchair, they thought that the jury might be sympathetic toward her. And but she fought, and we fought, and the prosecutor fought, and she was able to stay, but they tried to keep her out.
There is always this balance between victims' rights and the rights of the defendant, and there are legal experts who think that, for example, the testimony of the victim's loved ones in the sentencing portion of a trial tends to distort the process because then it makes something emotional when it should be legal.
I have just no patience with that kind of talk at all. I am so sick of the rights of criminals. I'm just sick of
their
rights.
But, of course, we do know some people are unjustly convicted,
yeah,
too.
That hasn't been my experience in anything I have covered.
Now, Judge Katz was hurt. What about the defense attorneys? They probably were helped by getting this guy off.
Yeah, I get
it. It's a good career thing. What did they do? What were their tactics?
Well, I mean, there was only the one, and he was the guy was penniless, and so he was. It was a lawyer assigned to him by the guy. A really unpleasant number. I really loathed him, and. He tried to come and shake hands with me after the trial, like he just beat me in tennis or something. And, I mean, he was a revolting figure.
Now, there are other people who had also been attacked by John Sweeney, and they weren't allowed to testify.
Yeah, right? That's right. That's
again, because the judge felt that would make prejudice the jury, but isn't that the whole point?
And also, what happened when one of these women was testifying? She was also a woman from a, as they say, nice family and with money. And prosecutor asked him a question about asked the woman on the stand about if she was rich, you know, and so forth. And Sweeney went crazy in the courtroom. The jury was not there, and he went crazy. He went absolutely out of his mind in the courtroom, and got up, and you saw the rage of a man who could kill. We all witnessed it, of course, except the jury. And it took three bailiffs to tackle him and knock him down, and then he had to be handcuffed to his chair. And the judge who should have punished him for this incredible disruption with people screaming in the courtroom, the judge says, "We know what a strain you are under, Mr. Sweeney."
Dominic Dunn is my guest. We'll continue right after this. We're back with Dominic Dunn. His new book is called Justice, Crimes, Trials, and Punishments. It is published by Crown. Mr. Dunn, of course, is the author of five best-selling novels, two collections of essays, most recently The Way We Lived Then, a memoir with photographs. He's a special correspondent for Vanity Fair. We were talking about this terrible tragedy, the trial of the man who killed your daughter. Everyone knew he killed your daughter, but the first-degree murder charge was eliminated entirely.
Yeah.
Isn't that usually something that's left to the to the jury to decide?
Yeah. It just everything went wrong.
So the judge made that kind of decision?
Everything went wrong. But, you know, Sweeney ended up testifying. And
Isn't that unusual in a case like this?
Yeah. And, you know, the thing that is so interesting about the whole thing is that the greatest tragedy of my life was also what redirected my life.
Mm-hmm.
And because the rage that I felt in that courtroom and what I saw can go on, when I saw this whole showbiz thing, which I've now seen throughout all the other trials, of dressing the killer all up so to make him appealing to the jury. In this case, they dressed him in black, like a sacristan in a Catholic seminary, and he piously read a Bible all the way through. I wanted to just puke, I have to tell you. And you know, the awful thing is, juries fall for that. I'd love to use the C.
Malarkey.
Word. Malarkey, thank you. Much better word.
He testified and he maligned your daughter.
He'd killed this woman. He killed her and then he killed her again. Whereas everything about his past was kept from the jury. His history, a history of violence against women.
It turns out that another article you wrote, which mentioned John Sweeney, actually saved a woman from marrying him.
Now, that was an amazing, just one of the life's most amazing things. That was years later. It was at the O.J. Simpson trial. And in Los Angeles, there is a famous private detective called Anthony Pelicano, a very interesting man, who is involved in all the main cases out there, Michael Jackson and all that stuff. And when Sweeney got out of I was mentioning him. He had something to do with Detective Mark Furman at the O.J. trial. And I said in my article that month, I have had a previous experience with Anthony Pelicano. I hired him to follow John Sweeney when he was gotten out of prison after 2.5 years. So a couple of, like 10 days later, after the magazine hit the stands, a man called the Vanity Fair magazine from Florida saying he had to talk to me. And so they called me, and I was in L.A. at the time. And he said, I've never read you before, and I was in the dentist, and there was a delay, and there was Vanity Fair, and I saw your name. I'd seen you on TV, and I read this article that you wrote. And he said, there's somebody in there that you named. And I said, who? And he said, John Sweeney. And John Sweeney, of course, was the killer.
Of course, this is a common name. There could have been other John.
But I know. Yeah. But it is a common name. And we both said the common name. And he told me this. And I said, that's the same guy. Mm-hmm. And he told me that his daughter was engaged to be married to this man. They lived in Seattle. And he said, do you think my daughter is safe? I said, are you out of your mind? I said, this is a man who beats women. And I said, a man who beats women, it's not a one-time thing. It happens over and over. Get your daughter out of there. So he called his daughter, asked her to read the article. She read the article, and when Sweeney came home, she said, is this you? And he didn't even look. He saw the man. He knew it had to be about it. And he pulled it out. He threw it down, and he said, that was a long time ago, and I've been in therapy ever since.
Oh, my.
And a big deal. And so the girl wanted to stay with him. And I told my son Griffin this. And my son, you know, he's a movie thing and stuff.
He's a producer and actor.
Actor and everything. And he called her. And said to her, what kind of a husband is this guy going to be? If you're engaged to be married to him, and he didn't tell you he'd been in prison for 2.5 years, and he didn't tell you that he had killed a girl, what kind of a marriage? And she left him.
So at least you did some good. You saved somebody.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that that it doesn't matter if they tell in some cases, if it's even known. Women seem to be attracted to some of these guys. You've written about the Klaus von Bülow case. He seems to have had any number of beautiful girlfriends, including one who you talk about a lot in your piece.
Andrea Reynolds.
And O.J. Simpson says that he's become a kind of a woman fly trap, practically, a human fly trap for beautiful women. They like the dangerous, he says.
Doesn't that just make you want to... I mean, I thought, are you referring to the article that was in the New Yorker magazine?
Quite recently,
quite recently about, if that was not the most pathetic, I mean, a brilliant article, but I mean, if his life, if that is not, that's just a rotten life that he is having. Couldn't be happier about that. He deserves prison, but it's a pathetic life he's living.
Well, Klaus von Bülow sure doesn't have a pathetic life. In fact, he's entered your field. He's now writing columns for New York Press and other publications.
I know. I shy from reading them. But he has been very much accepted back into London society. He doesn't live in New York. He can only live in New York 2 weeks a year. In the civil trial, that was the settlement that was made. It actually never went to trial, but they made a settlement. And his daughter, who had been cut out of the grandmother's will, was put back in and got her $75 million. And Klaus, she has to support her father, and they live in London.
Well, but he gets by on charm, doesn't he?
Total charm.
Is that what got him there in the first place? Is that what got him through? Because Sonny von Bülow was not the first woman in his life either. I mean, he's like John Sweeney. I guess people just...
Yeah, well,
true to their personalities.
Yeah, Klaus von Bülow had charm. There's no John Sweeney didn't have any charm. I have to admit about Klaus. He's a good storyteller. Women were attracted to him. There's no two ways about it. But he was also a major phony. You know, he was born Borberg was his name, Danish, and when he adopted the name of his maternal grandfather, which was Bülow, and then he first called himself in Paris Der Bülow, and then changed it to von Bülow. So, I mean, everything about him was fake from the beginning. As somebody said, he was trompe-l'oeil.
Who is, you mentioned Andrea Reynolds, who is she? Andrea, why did she have such an incredible... way of dealing with the press.
Actually, she's a fascinating woman, and she didn't appear until the second of his two trials. When he had been convicted after the first trial and sentenced to 30 years, Andrea Reynolds and her then husband Sheldon Reynolds, one of the greats of early television, a really great figure in early TV, whom I knew, and from my Hollywood days. And they moved in on Klaus, saying they believed him and so forth. And slowly, an affair started between Klaus and Andrea that broke up the marriage to Sheldon. And she became Klaus's, she became like, it was the most amazing thing. She sort of took over. She knew that case better than Dershowitz knew it, better than Tom Puccio knew it, better than anyone. And she was like the manipulator behind it. And she adored publicity. I mean, just couldn't get enough. And she was clever, and she was funny, and she was attractive. And I can remember... I mean, that was an amazing, that trial. It was an amazing, and it was an amazing look into the lives of the very, very rich. And I had two things happen. Andrea Reynolds gave a lunch party during the trial at Sonny von Bülow's New York apartment in this extravagant thing with butlers and white gloves and serving lobster salad and
drinking. Sonny's money.
On Sonny's money. It was just one of the most amazing. And then she took me back into Sonny's bedroom where she was then living on the weekends, and she was sitting on Sonny's bed showing me her. I mean, there was I always get involved in the story, as you can tell, which you shouldn't do, but I always do.
Well, because you're not a typical journalist, and there's often no pretense of objectivity in your writing.
None, and I think that's also what makes it popular.
My guest is Dominic Dunn. His latest book is called Justice, Crimes, Trials, and Punishments. It's published by Crown. You're listening to New York & Company on AM 820 WNYC in New York. I'm Leonard Lopez. This is another case of real miscarriage of justice, because I don't think anybody doubts that Sonny did it. Klaus did it to Sonny, yet the big punishment is that he has to live in London.
Yeah.
Not the worst thing in the world.
And with a daughter worth $75 million keeping him, so no, that wasn't so bad.
Did that make your blood boil again?
No, it didn't make my blood boil because that wasn't quite as much of a miscarriage of justice as the other one was.
Well, the O.J. Was pretty much a
well. That made my blood boil, and the Menendez brothers. I mean, at the end of that first trial, when it was a hung jury, there were more lies told in the Menendez trial, I think, than in any trial I have ever covered.
Do you think that was because of their defense attorney, Leslie Abramson?
Yeah, I do.
She's been a guest here. She's very charming and very convincing. I guess that's what defense lawyers are all about.
Yeah, she can't stand me and I can't stand her.
The Lyle and Eric Menendez had an odd relationship with their parents, depending on who you speak to. I get a feeling that you don't believe that their claims that they were ever sexually abused.
I don't believe that for one second. And I think that was all part of a phony defense that was made up. Jose Menendez was indeed a tough guy, a really tough guy, and had a mean streak in him. And my theory on that has always been that Eric Menendez was gay and that the father heaped scorn on him. He had a strange relationship with a...
I mean, he wanted him to become a real man.
And he was, a great athlete. I mean, he was a great tennis player. But he'd had a relationship of a friendship. I don't want to say relationship because I don't know that, with a guy called Craig Signorelli. And the father suspected that enough that he pushed Signorelli out of Eric's life. And I think, that the father probably picked on him and drove him to it. But instead, they changed the whole thing around so that the father turns out to be the gay. It's just unreal and unbelievable, and ultimately it didn't work.
You say the boys brought suspicion on themselves with their behavior following the double murder.
Well, listen.
And yet they got a hung jury in the first case.
Yeah, well, that was Leslie. I mean, she did a brilliant job, but I mean, and it was so infuriating. It was so infuriating what she did, but it worked. And she got a hung jury, which is a victory for her because there was no doubt that they had committed the murders. I mean, that was a given going into the trial. I mean, she really would like to have had Lyle take all the blame and win an acquittal for Eric.
That's because Lyle was not her client.
Yeah, that's right. But the family who was paying for it with Jose's money, by the way, it's interesting that Jose's whole fortune went so that nobody inherited anything. The whole fortune went into this trial.
The hard part to accept in all of this is that we're talking about a matricide-patricide and no remorse.
And listen, let me just tell you about this. If you want to kill your mother and father and you've been driven to that thing, I mean, I can't imagine.
There are abused children who do.
But abused children could get to that point. Then you go in And you shoot him. But they went in and they wounded him. I mean, arms, thighs, thing. They incapacitated them, probably so that they could tell him how much they hated him and the parents couldn't do anything before they killed him. And then they blew the back of the father's head off. Then they ran out of ammunition. Then they go out to the car in the fresh air night, thinking that I would think that might bring them to their senses. But oh no, they put more bullets into their 12-gauge shotguns. They came back in, and Lyle, who said in court, the mother was still alive, lying on the floor, and he said in court she was sneaking away. And he goes to her, and what's called a contact wound, when the end of the rifle touches your skin, and he blew off his mother's mouth, teeth, nose, and one eye. I've seen a picture of that woman. It is one of the most awful pictures I ever saw in my life. What kind of people are these?
So who's at fault here? defense attorneys will do everything possible to get their clients off. In a way, we understand that process. But judges are supposed to keep things on an even keel. Juries are supposed to be able to sift through all of the stupidity. How come that doesn't seem to be working?
Well, I don't know. I wish I could give you.
You've watched them. Have you walked out with a very different sense of how some of these trials were proceeding than what you finally saw the jury coming up with?
Yeah, well,
everybody in America thought O.J. was going to be convicted.
I did. I certainly did, and my mouth was hanging open, time, but you know, it seems to me at some time when the stories get as far fetched as they got in the Menendez case or in the O.J. case at times, that the judge ought to step in on it. I mean, really, when the reporters are groaning at the absurdity of what is being said. And, you know, every time I complain about it, some reporter would say, well, she's just doing her job, Dominic. Well, you know, I don't know if that is the job. I mean, to heap such... I mean, Jose was a tough guy, Martinet, expected too much out of his kids, but he was not the pervert that she turned him into.
You get upset all the time covering these trials. Do you prefer to be in that state?
Well, I do get upset, but I think I write better when I get all charged up. I mean, I just can't just accept it and say, oh, this is the way it's done. When lies are told, I mean, I believe in reporting on it.
So you get to pick and choose which things you're going to cover.
Yeah, and I only cover high-profile cases. I mean, I only cover, you know, where, awful to say, rich people who, I mean, every single one of these cases in the book, it's about a rich and a powerful person on trial.
And when you haven't been able to cover the trial, you've written novels about trials that that occurred before you had a chance to cover them.
That's right.
Like Mrs. Glenville. Well, this is a fascinating book, and I want to thank you so much for having been with us today to talk about it. Justice, Crimes, Trials, and Punishments, Dominic Dunn's book, published by Crown.